be back and to see some familiar faces again. It's been a while I've been here. So today I'll be talking about non-relativistic field theories without gravity mostly. And it's a specific class of non-relativistic theories, which we refer to as Aristotelian field theories. I'll be also mostly motivated by supersymmetry. So at least the last part of the talk will be supersymmetric. Although in order to motivate the background, I'll spend a lot of time in the first half of the talk explaining the origin of the word Aristotelian, what kind of field theories I'll be discussing specifically, because there's a lot of confusion in the literature about whatever is non-relativistic. I don't like defining areas of research by a negative, so referring to something as a non-relativistic theory just tells me what it's not. It doesn't tell me what it really is. So I'll clarify first what I'm really interested in this talk, what kind of non-relativistic symmetries are relevant. That will rule out some of the interesting areas. So if you all of a sudden realize that this is not of an interest to you, feel free to fall asleep in this nicely warm sauna-like environment. I hope the speaker won't fall asleep. That's the main goal for the talk. All right, so Aristotelian supersymmetry. Let me begin by giving you a few references. Most of the stuff that I'll be talking about in the supersymmetry context has not been published. It's based on an ongoing work in progress with Charles Melby Thompson, my current student Stephen Randall, and our brilliant undergraduate at Berkeley, Alex Frankel. But the buildup towards this particular area of research in the non-supersymmetric context can be traced through a bunch of references over the past several years with my former students, including Ziki, who is of course here. And so these are some good resources for catching up on some of the background prior to the introduction of supersymmetry in this non-relativistic context. So what is the Aristotelian spacetime? I'll be studying quantum field theory on rigid, fixed Aristotelian spacetimes. For simplicity, they will not be curved. They will not have non-trivial topologies. So they'll be topologically just r to some power d plus 1. I'll have only one time dimension. So the capital D refers to the number of spatial dimensions. For much of the talk, all spatial dimensions will be on the equal footing, and time will be special. Later on, we'll see that there is also some motivation why other splits into two groups of dimensions is interesting. Later on, I'll be splitting things into 1 plus 1 on one hand with relativistic two-dimensional symmetry plus the remaining spatial dimensions. But for now, let's start with the simplest example where time is special and the spatial dimensions are all on the same footing. So in this context, what I mean by an Aristotelian spacetime is the spacetime with the fixed flat metric, which contains the spatial part. So the indices I, j, and so on go over all the spatial dimensions. So it has a spatial metric, which is flat. It also has the 0, 0 component, so to speak, of the metric equal to 1, and no shift vector. So this looks formally almost like a Minkowski spacetime, except I am insisting on throwing away all the Boost symmetries. So the symmetries of the Aristotelian spacetime, or Aristotelian symmetries for short, will mean the isometries of this Aristotelian spacetime when I treat the time foliation by preferred constant time slices as a fixed geometric feature of the universe. So this Aristotelian spacetime will have isometries consisting of all spatial rotations and all space-time translations. No boosts, so that means no Lorentz boosts, no Galilean boosts. So if you're interested, let's say, only in Galilean or Schrödinger invariant field theories, this talk is not for you, because I'll be interested in what happens when you don't allow boosts as fundamental symmetries of nature. So these can be derived. These are not just postulated. They can be derived as symmetries by starting with a theory of quantum gravity on a spacetime with a foliation structure. So foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms might be a gauge symmetry. That type of a gravity theory, of course, I've been interested in developing over the past 10 or 15 years. And of course, that theory itself does not have a preferred rest frame. But once you find a ground state solution, let's say in that gravity theory you set the cosmological constant equal to 0, then this flat spacetime is a solution. And if you look at isometries, which are left over from all the underlying gauge structure, which are isometries of the ground state solution, then you see that the isometries, the subgroup of all foliation preserving diffeomorphisms morphisms that preserve that metric structure of the ground state of Lifshitz gravity with zero cosmological constant is exactly this Aristotelian symmetry group. So in that sense, these symmetries emerge as an emergent rest frame type of structure, even in theories of gravity which have no a priori fixed rest frame. So yes, as a consequence, this Aristotelian spacetime is a spacetime with a preferred rest frame, and that will have all kinds of consequences. For example, particles that are moving with a certain momentum might self-decay. A single particle might self-decay into multiple copies of itself with the lower momenta, unlike in relativistic or even Galilean invariant field theories. So this spacetime is often called in the semi-recent literature, by that I mean over the past 10 years, has been called the Lifshitz spacetime, which I find very confusing, and also ahistorical as a name. The reason for that is that these so-called Lifshitz spacetimes were not first named or introduced by Lifshitz. In fact, they were introduced by two luminaries of general relativity, Andrzej Trautmann in Poland and Roger Penrose in England in the early 60s. And in particular, if you look at the very influential booklet by Roger Penrose from 1968 on the structure of spacetime, which is one of the early resources for applying spinner techniques to general relativity, he begins that booklet by summarizing the history of the evolution of the concept of spacetime, saying that before the curved spacetime of Einstein, there was, of course, Minkowski, which is flat, but still relativistic. Before that, there was Galilean, which has relative space, but still insists on absolute time. And they say, before that, there was an Aristotelian spacetime, which has both the absolute space and the absolute time. And even in that set of lectures from 1968, and in lectures by both authors even prior to that, they actually quite explicitly say the isometries of the Aristotelian spacetime are exactly what I had on this first transparency here. So I think it doesn't make sense to reinvent some new names for this spacetime. It's just perfectly good to call them Aristotelian spacetimes, following in the footsteps of not Lifshitz, but Trautmann and Penrose. So
what's the difference between the last two?
Between which last two?
Galilean and Aristotelian.
Galilean spacetime is a foliation, so it has Galilean boosts. You can boost with velocities along the spatial slices, but the Aristotelian spacetime has no boost symmetry. It has an absolute rest frame. The boosts are not a part of the symmetry group. That's the crucial distinction. So that makes these types of non-relativistic field theories very different from many of the ones that you can find in the literature, which typically would have some form of Galilean symmetry. I'll never be interested in Galilean symmetry here. I'll be interested in theories which are either only Aristotelian invariant, or they developed an automatic low-energy Lorentz symmetry later on in the supersymmetric context. So this is my terminology. So instead of Lifshitz, I think Aristotle is a better term. It also avoids some confusion with the notion of the Lifshitz spacetime in holography, which is a deformation of ADS, which provides dualities for non-relativistic systems. So this is what I mean by Aristotelian spacetimes. And the question is, why is it interesting to study quantum field theory on such non-relativistic spacetimes? My main motivation goes back to the fact that I'm interested in non-relativistic gravity to see whether it can be a useful alternative, for example, for holography to conventional GR or conventional string theory. Also, can it be a useful alternative or an extension for phenomenology for describing our actual physical universe? That's a very ambitious and long-term program. So in order to understand details of the quantum structure of non-relativistic gravity, we need to learn the basics first. How do you treat quantum field theory in these unusual environments without boost symmetries? One of the main motivations for today will not be gravity, but it's going to be this point two here on the list. I'm going to be using Aristotelian quantum field theories to provide possible new short-distance UV completions of relativistic quantum field theories. So this is the main motivation for the time being for looking at the supersymmetric context, because, for example, in the supersymmetric field theories, we know many examples, or several very good examples, of supersymmetric relativistic quantum field theories, which are only low energy field theories. The simplest example might be the 2+1 dimensional supersymmetric nonlinear sigma model. And the question is, can we provide new UV completions which would not require, let's say, stringy degrees of freedom and embedding into a full machinery of string theory? So asymptotically, the main motivation for that particular set of questions in the supersymmetric context would be, can we find new UV completions for 6-dimensional supersymmetric field theories, specifically? I'm also going to mention in passing some applications to the notion of technical naturalness for questions such as the naturalness of the Higgs mass or the naturalness of a small cosmological constant, which is phenomenologically, of course, at the forefront of our interest in recent years, especially given the lack of new physics at the LHC, the question of technical naturalness of the standard model and its combination with quantum gravity is back at the core of interesting questions. So I'll show you some simple applications to the notion of naturalness for some simple scalar field theories, which you can think of as proxies to the Higgs of the standard model. And I'll use that set of research results to kind of motivate the differences between Aristotelian quantum field theories and the typical relativistic or Galilean ones that you might be more used to, so that we have some understanding of what's different for these theories before we jump to supersymmetry. There are always possible spin-off applications to condensed matter. They kind of come without even you looking for them, because after all, you're dealing with systems which are inherently non-relativistic. So we found some applications in the past to possible mechanisms for high TC superconductivity, which I won't be able to mention much in the bulk of the talk. But if you're interested, I'm staying here for the rest of the afternoon, so you can ask me questions. You also see that it's interesting from the purely mathematical physics perspective, because it opens up new classification programs and gives new interesting invariants of mathematical structures. But again, that's very tangential to the interest of the talk. So I'll mostly skip that subject after I motivate some of the highlights of the results. And finally, kind of tied together with the motivation number one here is this last point here. We have a beautiful theory of quantum gravity in the form of string theory and M theory. And I'm always curious to see how much of string theory and M theory we actually have uncovered so far, and how much of it is still hiding in corners which we haven't thought of discovering yet. And in particular, how big is the area of non-relativistic, quote unquote, string theory? Are there big chunks of string theory, of the string theory landscape which we still haven't even touched? So I have nothing specific to say about this last question, but it's certainly a good motivation to explore things like possible non-relativistic versions of super Young Mills as possible low energy limits of whatever non-relativistic versions of string theory you might be interested in studying. So to summarize the gravitational context, again, just to set some notation here, as you know, I've been interested for the past 10 years at least in gravity on spacetimes with a preferred time foliation. And the idea is that in that context, you can use conventional normalization group techniques to set up possible free field fixed points to define the theory in the ultraviolet as a conventional renormalizable quantum field theory at the cost of allowing anisotropic scaling at short distances. So in the simplest case, where you split off one time dimension versus the remaining spatial dimensions, you might allow this anisotropy in the scaling if space scales with the power of one of this lambda scaling parameter. Time can scale with a different power, z, which is known as the dynamical critical exponent. I'm assuming that you have seen by now enough holography or enough non-relativistic, non-equilibrium physics and such that you're familiar with this concept. It's an important observable. I'm not going to be reminding you of how many examples of interesting systems we have in various fields of physics where z is not equal to 1, which would be the conventional value of it in relativistic Lorentz invariant systems. So now we can extend successfully the idea of non-relativistic anisotropic scaling to a whole bunch of theories of gravity in various dimensions with various values of z and play with the structure. And as I said, it's kind of difficult to do loop calculations in these settings simply because you have many more derivatives, many more indices. Everything becomes order of magnitude more technical than in the relativistic setting. So let's explore some simpler examples on that fixed Aristotelian space-time background. So I'm going back to my flat d plus one dimensional uncompactified space-time with the flat metric, and I'm asking for quantum field theories, which at first have these isometries as symmetries, but also if I'm studying them with the context of the randomization group, I'll find various fixed points, and at those fixed points, the symmetry will be extended to what I would call, for the lack of a better term, an isotropic conformal symmetry. That does not mean that there will be any special conformal transformations. Typically, the extension at a fixed point will involve, besides the isometries, only the scaling symmetry with a constant scaling parameter lambda, no special conformal transformations. But since these scale transformations are involved, that's the best you can come up with in this Aristotelian setting, closest to the concept of conformal. So I'll for short use that same term, an isotropic conformal, as I would in the relativistic setting. So let's look at some simple examples. The simplest example would be a simple scalar field, a real scalar field, which you might make more appealing, more exciting by thinking of it as the analog of the Nambu-Goldstone mode. In the non-relativistic setting, you can ask what is the analog of the Goldstone theorem, which would control the pattern of symmetry breaking and Nambu-Goldstone modes from the relativistic theory. In the relativistic case, the Goldstone theorem completely answers the classification problem of Nambu-Goldstone modes. It states that for every global internal continuous symmetry that's broken, you get exactly one Nambu-Goldstone mode, which is gapless, which means massless in relativistic dimensions, and the dispersion is exactly frequency equals the momentum in absolute value. And the reason why this is a stable concept in the sense of being protected by symmetries is that this exact Nambu-Goldstone mode exhibits a constant shift symmetry. So if I have one Nambu-Goldstone mode, I can shift it by a constant, and that protects the gaplessness of the dispersion relation. In the non-relativistic case, the classification is far from over, far from complete. There have been various partial attempts. In particular, my Berkeley colleagues at the time, Hitoshi and Haruki, in 2012 and 13, provided a partial classification where they said, we certainly see two types of Nambu-Goldstone modes. Let's call them type A and type B, depending on whether they have a linear dispersion or a quadratic dispersion. And that seems to be generic, so maybe that provides the full classification. That turned out not to be quite yet the full answer. We still don't have the full answer, but we at least can provide a more refined answer to the question of how to classify in the Aristotelian spacetime scalar field theories that can represent Nambu-Goldstone modes. So I want to quickly recall the notion of technical naturalness, which is tangential to my talk, but perhaps interesting in this scalar field context. So a scalar field theory in, let's say, four relativistic dimensions has a mass parameter and a lambda phi to the four self-coupling, which both have to be of the same order epsilon in the units of the naturalness scale mu, simply because they both break the same underlying constant shift symmetry that I mentioned earlier. If this condition is not satisfied, if lambda and m squared are not of the same order in the units of the mass, then the theory is fine-tuned. And if it does satisfy this condition, we speak of it as a technically natural theory. And that's the condition that would be violated by the Higgs in the presence of some high scale like the quantum gravity scale in the standard model. Now, in the Aristotelian case, you can ask similarly, what are some of the possible symmetries and what kind of symmetry breaking patterns can emerge? It turns out that if you write down a kinetic term, which is also of second order in first derivatives for the scalar field, but now begins with a much higher order, 2k in spatial derivatives, then this type of a kinetic term will give a dispersion relation of order k. And strangely enough, it wasn't discovered until we started working on this problem that there is actually an extended hidden symmetry that protects this type of dispersion relation. So this is an an extension of the constant shift symmetry that I mentioned for the relativistic scalar, and it is an example of a novel phenomenon which does not have any analog in relativistic settings. So I'm mostly pointing this out to you as an illustration why Aristotelian symmetries and field theories are so intriguing, because they have features which are not present in relativistic field theories. And we want to know more of those and see if we can apply them to useful physical questions. So the symmetry that... The group of symmetries consists of... It's up to you to choose, but you choose your degree of a polynomial instead of a constant shift symmetry. You can postulate a polynomial shift symmetry by polynomials of a certain degree in spatial Cartesian coordinates. So in that sense, there's a finite number of generators, but you can make it arbitrarily large by choosing the degree of the polynomial to be arbitrarily high. And that will protect for you a polynomial dispersion relation with z being an arbitrary integer in principle at the classical level. Quantum mechanically, of course, you at some point start running into infrared divergences. So there's going to be a natural cutoff on the value of z depending on the space-time dimension in the case of type A. And similarly, you can also generalize the type B quadratic dispersion relation to be technically natural as omega scaling as k to the 2z for any even integer in the exponent here. And for them, there is no upper limit, so you can make, again, the dispersion arbitrarily high. That doesn't mean that it's easy to find physical systems which exhibit these dispersion relations, but if you, for example, in your material search, find a material where a phonon, let's say, exhibits a higher degree dispersion relation like this, then you know in retrospect it will be protected by this emergent polynomial shift symmetry. So in that sense, it's a useful technical tool if you are interested in model building things which do not require fine tuning, both in condensed matter and in high energy physics. So as I said, we've refined in this way the classification of Nambu-Goldstone modes in Aristotelian spacetimes into two infinite hierarchies, type A and type B, each labeled by the value of the integer exponent. So certainly this theory shows you that Aristotelian field theories are much, much richer than what we expect from relativistic ones. Even in the case of a simple single component scalar field, the story is much more surprising than we expected. So now that we have these new polynomial shift symmetries, by the way, if there are people in the audience who are interested in the Galileans in the context of cosmology, you have seen an analog of a polynomial shift symmetry in that context, because Galileans are built as theories which are invariant under linear shift symmetries in all space-time variables, not in just spatial coordinates. And that's probably the reason why they don't have a natural extension to things quadratic in polynomials and so on, because then you will run into kinetic terms which violate unitarity. But in this context, our kinetic terms will be still of second order in time derivatives. Everything is perturbatively unitary, and you have this infinite hierarchy of symmetries. You can start asking, if this gives me a nice pattern for free field fixed points, what are some of the self-interactions that might self-consistently emerge and satisfy these polynomial shift symmetries? And that's a very interesting mathematical problem, which we worked on some years back with Zicky and my other students at the time. And they convinced me that it's a beautiful mathematical problem, which when you set up the question, what is the list of invariants I can build for the Lagrangian that satisfy the invariants under polynomial shift symmetry up to a total derivative, it effectively defines a new cohomology theory for graphs. So I'm completely skipping the graph theory part of the talk. I'll just flash a few transparencies. If you are curious about the story, you can ask me or Zicky afterwards. Long story short, if you choose your degree of the polynomial and ask for an endpoint invariant with delta pairs of spatial derivatives in d spatial dimensions, you get a list of non-trivial linear independent invariants. Typically, generically, the numbers of such invariants would be zero in low enough values of d and delta and d. But in higher ones, you develop a graph mapping on this of this cohomology equation. And I don't want to talk about what the graph language looks like, but it allows you to classify using some simple theorems from graph theory from pure mathematics. You can classify these lowest dimension operators of a certain number of fields that satisfy a certain given polynomial shift symmetry. So just to glance one picture, this complicated thing represents a unique, most relevant invariant, which is a four-point object. So it contains four fields and is invariant under a quintic shift symmetry. You can, from this algorithmically, decode what it looks like in the language of field theory. So in any case, some of these cohomology groups that this defines, we calculated explicitly in this paper years back, and again illustrates how rich and surprising the story is, even for simple single-component scalar fields. So now the question is, how many more surprises are waiting when we go from scalars to things like gauge field theories, or maybe even quantum gravity? So hopefully, I'll have something to say about gauge theories, and specifically supersymmetry gauge theories. But for now, I want to, again, quickly flash the possible application. Now that you guys have seen that scalar fields can have these higher degree polynomial shift symmetries, can we use it for particle phenomenology? And naively, you would say, no, this is ruled out because I cannot mess with the standard model. We have such excellent bounds on possible violations of Lorentz invariance. And surely, if I make, let's say, the Higgs sector in the standard model deeply non-relativistic at short scales, I'm definitely going to mess up Lorentz phenomenology. Surprisingly, that's not necessarily true. And in fact, there is a nice way out of this potential danger, which allows you to propose a new hypothetical solution of the Higgs-Mass hierarchy problem. So let's spend some time, now that we've seen free field theories with anisotropic scaling, let's start with a simple example in 2+1 dimensions. So these first two terms in white define a z equal to 2 fixed point at short distances. This is how I define the theory in the UV. It's going to have z equal to 2 scaling, which is particularly nice in 2+1 dimensions. Now I'm turning on a relevant deformation, which is of only second order in first spatial derivatives. That's going to be playing the role of the so far missing spatial part of the relativistic kinetic term. And if I only had these three terms in the theory and didn't include anything else, or maybe we can include the mass term for free, for sure. If I had these first four terms, this is a free field theory which trivially flows from z equal to 2 in the UV to z equal to 1 in the infrared. Nothing very exciting. I can turn on a self-coupling for the theory. So this is a four-point self-interaction with enough derivatives so that this coupling G does not break constant shift symmetry. It would break linear and higher shift symmetries. And already in this simple setting, one can show by running the same estimation argument that was behind the naturalness values in the relativistic phi to the fourth theory, you can argue that now you have actually two different epsilons to play with. You can start with the theory which has linear shift symmetry and break that linear shift symmetry at some high scale, and then wait for a long time in the RG sense before you break the constant shift symmetry. So there are now epsilon 0 and epsilon 1, and as long as epsilon 1, which controls the breaking of the linear shift symmetry, is much higher than epsilon 0, which controls the breaking of the remaining constant shift symmetry, and everybody is smaller than 1, then this theory will be technically natural. So this is a way of opening up new hierarchies which were not available in a similar setting for the relativistic scalar field theory. You can repeat the same thing in 3+1 dimensions. So I wrote down one particularly interesting test example which we played with in our discussion of the Higgs with Zicky and company. So this starts in 3+1 physical real dimensions with a z equal to 3 fixed point. Those are the two terms in white. And then there is a z equal to 2 part of the kinetic term, z equal to 1 relativistic kinetic term, and so on. And I turn on the one and unique linear shift invariant, which is a four-point self-interaction. This happens to be a classically marginal term. So lambda here is a dimensionless coupling classically. It will develop in principle logarithmic running. That's a long and interesting story, but I don't want to spend more time studying this model. I'll just tell you how to apply it to the Higgs hierarchy problem. The application will follow from observing that now that we have a theory which satisfies a higher shift symmetry, not just linear, but at least quadratic shift symmetry in the UV, where the z equal to 3 terms dominate, you can now have three different epsilons controlling the breaking from quadratic shift symmetry to linear shift symmetry to constant shift symmetry to null symmetry. And those can be hierarchically organized. And it's up to you to decide how large these hierarchies should be without spoiling technical naturalism. So you can use that, as we did in our paper from a couple of years back, to the problem of the Higgs naturalness by saying, let's take the Higgs-less part of the standard model, make it perfectly relativistic, don't mess with that, and take the Higgs sector, make the Higgs sector the O4 natural extension. So this theory is written here for just a single scalar component, but if you promote it into an ON scalar of SON, it's straightforward and the action looks the same. There's a unique self-coupling which has that invariance. So for O4, of course, this is like the Higgs in the standard model. And then you can play the same game. This still holds true. This hierarchy of scales extends to the non-abelian version of the Higgs. And you can then say, I take this deeply non-relativistic at the UV scale Higgs sector, couple it to the rest of the standard model, and ask whether the epsilons can be selected in such a way that, first of all, I solve the hierarchy problem. And second of all, or maybe the first requirement should be, first of all, I don't spoil the bounds on Lorentz violations at low energies. And then perhaps see how much this buys you in terms of solving the hierarchy problem. So quantum properties of the model I'm skipping. I'm just going to tell you that you can view this model from the point of view of several different observers. And this is somewhat important for that supersymmetric picture. So I want to explain what I mean here. If you define the theory in the UV, I would call the observers who use that UV part of the action as the definition of the theory, these two terms. So pick this coefficient in front of this term to be 1. You have now committed to some particular relation between time and space. It's deeply anisotropic because you have used the z equal to 3 fixed point to say how you relate time and space. You are a deeply Aristotelian observer. You have no idea that at low energies, the system will develop a low energy emergent Lorentz symmetry. But you might also be a different observer, a very low energy observer, who wants to set the speed of light equal to 1 because you have the prejudice that you see Lorentz invariance at low energies, perhaps with high energies modifying the Lorentz symmetry by corrections which violate Lorentz by contributions from terms like these. So in order to get from the Aristotelian observer to the Lorentz low energy observer, you have to perform a rescaling and absorption of this c squared into spatial coordinates, essentially. So there are those two, at least, different types of observers. There's also a Wilsonian observer, which I don't want to get into. When you run the randomization group in the Wilsonian sense, it turns out that you want to be kind of continuously changing the relation between time and space of the Aristotelian observer, because there's a priori no relation. There's a logarithmic renormalization of the relation, which suggests that even at the Aristotelian short scale structure, there are two different types of observers possible. Yeah.
Sure. The problem with the Higgs-less hierarchy problem is that you calculate the loops, the Higgs loops, and they're quadratically divergent. So what happens if you try to calculate these loops?
Here, the UV behavior is much better because the Higgs, the theory has a much better, it has an improved UV behavior, but of course you still get polynomial divergences, which are the ones that I'm trying to control by not having to fine tune. Because of the emergent symmetries, you find out that some coefficients, even though they might be coefficients in front of polynomial power law divergences, they are small because of the extra hidden symmetry. The polynomial shift symmetry controls the size of those. So essentially that's the punchline. I'm not hiding power law divergences under the carpet. I'm just calculating them as honestly as I can and seeing that in this non-relativistic context, they can be small because of the extra symmetry. Yeah, there are quadratic and cubic and quartic divergences actually in this setting because, absolutely. There's more divergences. Because you have more relevant terms. So, because even the speed squared term in the action is a relevant deformation. So that gets a quadratic divergence in the units of the UV momentum. And the mass term gets a quartic divergence in the units of the UV momentum in the simplest z equal to 2 case. So I'm happy to explain more about this after the talk, but this is tangential for now. So I'm just trying to quote the results because I think I want to get to the meat of the, or tofu, depending on whether you're vegetarian, which is the supersymmetric part of the talk. Okay, so never mind the Wilsonian observers. They are an interesting feature having to do with different ways of performing renormalization in these. Oh, and Rob had a question.
Yeah, I just wondered, do you have a gauge symmetry breaking? You're referring to this gauge.
So. Oh, yeah. So this actually, it becomes a, that's a very good point because I would claim in this model, and this is on one of the transparencies. So I hope to answer a question in 2 minutes. I just want to here make the distinction between the short distance observers and the Lorentz low energy observers. And that is by absorbing the coefficient that measures the speed of light into the spatial coordinates so that the low energy physics is organized in a way which starts with the Lorentz invariant low energy part of the Lagrangian and sees all the higher derivative pieces as small corrections. So there's some appropriate redefinition of things which makes this all possible. And then you can view any theory from these two different points of view. The UV point of view, which is deeply Aristotelian, and that sees all these terms as relevant deformations. Each of them will, in principle, get parallel divergences. Lambda can, in principle, have a log divergence. But then the infrared observer reassembles things into this relativistic part, which looks like the Higgs sector, plus non-relativistic Lorentz-violating corrections. So these coefficients are calculable in terms of those. This is a simple translation. This is how you define the quantum theory, how you calculate, and this is how you interpret it for the LHC, let's say. And long story short, if it weren't for gauge couplings, then we would be able to, using this mechanism, have a perfectly technically natural light scalar where we can propose using these epsilon 0, epsilon 1, and epsilon 2, never mind the numerology, I can discuss afterwards if you're interested. If you pick epsilon 0 to be 10 to the minus 30, which is supposed to be much smaller than epsilon 1, which will be 10 to the minus 20, epsilon 2, 10 to the minus 10, remember, one of them controls what the speed of light is in terms of the renormalization group scale, then you can actually open up a very nice hierarchy all the way between the Higgs mass and the Planck scale without seeing dangerous Lorentz violations. All the Lorentz violating terms are just around the corner. That's how we pick these numbers. They would show up at the LHC next week, roughly speaking. So in that sense, that's the bottom-up phenomenology that we were basing these guess numbers on. So they do give you an 18 order of magnitude hierarchy of scales, which is great. But the grain of salt lies in the gauge coupling sector, as Rob was anticipating. Yukawa couplings and fermions, they go nicely along with for the ride. Everything is fine. But when you try to gauge, you find out that keeping those 18 orders of magnitude of a hierarchy will force you into gauge couplings, which are just phenomenologically not viable. So you have to reconsider. And this was done by Zicky and collaborators in a follow-up paper. They started by dialing the correct gauge couplings in the standard model and asked how much of the hierarchy can we still gain by this mechanism. I naively expected that they wouldn't get a single order of magnitude, but by a beautiful calculation, they actually show that they claim it could be as many as 7, but if you are conservative, at least 2 orders of magnitude of a hierarchy, you're still buying by this mechanism. So this is at least as viable as any phenomenologically accepted possibility for solving the hierarchy for the time being, given the absence of new physics. The new physics here would be, of course, no new particle, but a crossover into a non-relativistic dispersion relation for first the heaviest particles that get the most of the mass from the Higgs. And the Higgs itself, of course, would be seeing non-relativistic corrections to their dispersion relation at some point soon, but the bounds have been used such that it doesn't spoil the current limit on Lorentz violations. So again, many surprises, even for the scalar case. So to summarize, instead of having this relativistic necessity of theories which are technically natural being controlled by one epsilon parameter, and therefore if the hierarchy between the masses is very large, the Higgs coupling would be extremely tiny, we now have at least one more knob here. We can make the hierarchy large, but we can make the Higgs coupling of order 1. So a technically natural light scalar is possible. But as Rob was anticipating, it's much more difficult to make this consistent with the correct way of gauging this image. So for the gauging, you have also the gauge couplings, which don't have as favorable scaling with epsilons as the Higgs coupling. So now finally to supersymmetry. And now my main motivation will be, I mean, there are many different questions you could ask. And I'll ask a specific question. Can I have a deeply Aristotelian supersymmetric field theory? So first of all, we have to decide what is an Aristotelian supersymmetry. But I'll ask not just for a generic Aristotelian field theory. I'll ask for theories which automatically grow emergent super Poincaré invariants in the infrared. Is it even possible to have such a situation? And if so, what is the list of theories? And how crazy do they have to be in the UV in order to be flowing automatically to Lorentz invariant theories in the infrared? So we are used to the fact that supercharges typically square to Hamiltonians in supersymmetric field theories. And I want to keep that feature, which of course, in the deep UV regime will disallow the presence of spatial momenta in the supertranslations algebra. And it's true that if I postulate this algebra, then it's very easy to write down interacting field theories for scalars, super multiplets, gauge fields, anything you want. But it's going to be very, very difficult to see them flow to relativistic theories in the infrared. Generically, they will not be relativistic in the infrared. They'll just stay non-relativistic throughout the whole range of scales. They might flow to z equal to 1, but there'll be, for example, fermions. They don't even have to be space-time spinners. They can be scalars or some other representations of the spatial symmetries. And there's no spin statistics theorem for these theories, so nothing goes wrong. Formally, you can have supersymmetric theories like that. But I'm only going to be interested in those that do flow to a relativistic supersymmetric theory. So let's study an example. And we'll see how the mechanism goes. It wasn't easy to construct. I was actually quite surprised how difficult it turned out. We started with the first example in 2010. So this was just months after we worked on Lifshitz gravity. My student Charles Melby Thompson at the time and I looked at that question. Can you write down, let's say, for a West Zumino multiplet in 2+1 dimensions? Can you write down a theory which has this flow from a deeply non-relativistic supersymmetry where supercharges only square to the Hamiltonian to super Poincaré? And we found out that, yes, it's possible for the linear sigma model. It's then straightforwardly possible for the nonlinear sigma model. But we had infinitely hard times trying to extend it to super Yang-Mills, even in 2+1 dimensions. So much of the progress since then, over the past few years, has had to do with being able to come up with a few examples where Yang-Mills is consistent with this. So let me begin with this basic West Zumino-like example first. So the supermultiplet will have, in 2+1 dimensions, a real scalar and a Majorana real fermion. And I'm making them already consistent with the anticipated representations of the super Poincaré. So it's a discrete choice. This is not fine-tuning in any sense, the choice of fields that I'm putting in into the theory. And then in the UV, if you write down, just to jump directly to the punchline, if you write down this theory, this will certainly, under these supersymmetry rules, will be a very simple realization of a free field theory where the supercharges defined through this n equals 1 supersymmetry squared to the Hamiltonian. That's very, very elementary. And it's also very elementary to make this consistent with self-interactions. You can turn on self-interactions as you would do in a normal supersymmetric field theory. Now, what are the relevant deformations of this theory? This theory, as written here, has z equal to 2 scaling in the UV. And the supersymmetry is consistent with that. But there is no analog of the low energy speed of light term. There is nothing which would have only first derivatives squared of the scalar field. And that you would need in order to flow into the infrared and become accidentally somehow Poincaré invariant. So how does that work? You can classify all relevant deformations of this theory, which should preserve the superalgebra, and find out that there are none, except if you allow for the superalgebra itself to flow. So that's the novelty that you need already at the simplest scalar supermultiplet level. If you allow the superalgebra to flow, the supersymmetric rules are now explicitly dependent on the relevant parameter C. The superalgebra will then also depend on this relevant parameter C. But it's just a reformulation, rewriting, a cosmetic rewriting of the standard super Poincaré by reintroducing explicitly the C piece in the super translation algebra. So that's nice, because now you can check that if you look at this deformed theory and integrate out this auxiliary field if you want, this will indeed take the form, even for interacting theories, of something that is super Poincaré invariant at low energies, plus Lorentz violating higher corrections. So the remaining part of the Poincaré is kind of automatically implied by the fact that everybody shares the same speed of light between the scalars and the fermions. So this is a simple example, and as I said, this is the one that we found after like a 1 week of trying in 2010, and then we got stuck not knowing how to extend to super Young-Mills. So let's see if we can gain a different perspective on this problem, on this particular construction, which, so I'll now study this same theory defined here. So far, I've studied it in what I called earlier the coordinates of the Aristotelian observer from the UV point of view, where space and time don't scale the same way. They have a different dimension. But I find it convenient to rephrase things in the language where I absorb this C into the definition of X, so that this first term here and that term here will provide the bosonic relativistic kinetic term at low energies plus corrections. So I'll switch to this low energy Lorentz observer's point of view, and that Lorentz observer certainly sees a standard super translations algebra at all scales. You can think of it as kind of being contracted at high energies, but that only happens from the point of view of the rescaled Aristotelian coordinates. From the point of view of the low energy coordinates, the entire super translations algebra is equally valid across all scales, but it does not necessarily extend by all Lorentz generators. So if you ask for the full symmetry of the theory, it's the super translations and only a subset of the naive symmetries of super Poincaré spacetimes. Only spatial rotations you're adding to super translations. And that's what I would call Aristotelian supersymmetry. It's actually surprising how many people are puzzled often by the fact that super translations do not automatically imply Lorentz symmetry. I think it's a very trivial and obvious statement, but there is a lot of confusion about that in the literature. Some people claiming that it's a surprise that if you postulate this algebra, then Lorentz invariance is not implied. Of course, it's not, because it's up to you to decide which of the Lorentz generators you add, and only once you've made that commitment, you try to classify invariants and see what you get. Rob?
Okay, so the side fields, you said they were layer ones, and they?
Yeah, I picked fields which are consistent with the super Poincaré in 2 plus 1 dimension. So this is n equals 1 in 2 plus
okay,
1.
So they're in representations of spin that the Lagrangian frames.
That's right, yeah, exactly. So I choose representations judiciously, because if I choose the representations the wrong way, there's no chance I'm going to flow. But it's not fine tuning. It's just a choice of, I make that a priori choice of representations, and it just happens that I made that the choice that allows me to flow to the infrared, which generically, if I make wrong choices of representations, would not happen. A generic Aristotelian field theory will never flow to anything relativistic. But here I'm interested only in those that do. So. That's the logic. Okay, so Aristotelian supersymmetry. Take the point of view of the lower energy Lorentz observer that allows you to have super translations in the standard form at all scales, and add only rotations and space-time translations, which are already represented here by P mu, and that's the Aristotelian supersymmetry group. It's best to do things in superspace, so in retrospect, it's not surprising that the theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions made sense, because we have standard supercharges, standard covariant derivatives, standard real superfields in 2 plus 1 superspace. We just don't respect Lorentz boosts. That's the only novelty here, and gives you new freedoms. For example, you can write down the standard kinetic term for the Bazzumino multiplet in superspace. It would involve two superderivatives. Of course, those superderivatives, each of them has a canonical dimension 1/2, which for z equal to 2 scaling happens to be also the canonical dimension of the spatial derivative. So you can also look at a term here in white which has the same scaling dimension in the UV as this one had. And it just replaces these two supercovariant derivatives by a pair of contracted spatial derivatives. And clearly, this is going to be the correct superspace formulation for the missing part of the low energy relativistic kinetic term from the point of view of the infrared physics. So, sorry, for this is the UV completion. Sorry, this is the z, the higher derivatives z equal to 2 UV completion of the theory. And then you can turn on interactions, and that gives you the rest of the story. So this would be an example of an Aristotelian UV completion of a relativistic supersymmetric field theory, especially if you go from here to a nonlinear sigma model, which of course would be power counting non-normalizable in 2 plus 1 dimensions with relativistic scaling. But you can easily generalize the story from the previous transparency to n equals 1 SUSY nonlinear sigma models. The novelty is, compared to the previous transparency, I'm essentially doing the same. I'm defining the theory in the UV by having two terms. One of them gives me both the time derivative term and the spatial part of the low energy relativistic kinetic term, and the other one provides the higher derivative UV completion. Except now they are decorated by a target space metric, because I have now not just one superfield phi, but a curved target space parameterized by these superfields. So I have a target space metric which shows up in this term, and yet another target space metric. These don't have to be the same, which happens to be in front of this other term. So this in the target space is a theory which is a two-metric, a bimetric theory of gravity on the target space. And this theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions is, of course, power counting and normalizable. So you can try and calculate beta functions as a functional of these two metrics, which has not been, to my knowledge, done yet. But it's an interesting generalization of the conventional two-dimensional relativistic supersymmetric sigma models. So it's probably of interest and presumably embeddable into bigger theories like string theory in some fashion and so on. So can we have extended Aristotelian supersymmetry? We worked at first on n equals 2 extensions of the nonlinear sigma model. See how much time I have. And at first it seems difficult. Some naive guesses don't work unless the theory is completely free. But then you can do things in n equals 2 superspace and actually discover a very interesting class of n equals 2 supersymmetric Aristotelian sigma models with z equal to 2 scaling in the UV. So again, they're power counting renormalizable. The amount of supercharges is now 4 real supercharges. And you can ask, what does it take for the target space to allow this type of n equals 2 extended supersymmetry? You remember, that's an interesting question in the relativistic two-dimensional sigma model setting. You can ask, what does it take to have n equals 2, n equals 4? And you get more and more constraining conditions on the geometry. Here, it's even more constraining. And that came to us as a surprise at first. But now I'm getting used to this pattern that these theories are much more difficult to construct, much more constrained in the non-relativistic setting, because more structure is required in order to complete the construction than in the analogous cases in the relativistic setting. So here, the novelty here is that you can have a Kähler term. So first of all, you'll have to have a Kähler metric on the target space. So there is a Kähler potential here that gives you the conventional part in the full Grassmannian four-dimensional superspace of that relativistic theory. The higher derivative completion, however, can only be written with the use of the chiral measure at the cost of having to introduce a holomorphic non-degenerate two tensor in the theory, which I would call for short a holomorphic metric. So the structure that you're asked to put on n equals 2 such target spaces is not just a Kähler metric, like in the relativistic two-dimensional case, but a Kähler metric with a holomorphic metric. That's quite a constraining set of geometric data. If the target space were compact manifold, the Calabi-Yau construction actually proves that the only solution would be complex tori. For non-compact target spaces, you are still allowed to have structures which are non-trivial, non-free theories. So it's quite more constraining than in the relativistic setting, not quite restricting you to only free field theories, but almost. So that's one example of how these structures are more difficult to find, and they're rarer than relativistic supersymmetric field theories. Now, if you can construct a nonlinear sigma model, then my instinct is you can certainly start with a sigma model with an isometry, and you should be able to gauge that isometry. So gauge theory should exist in that same number of dimensions, with that same number of supersymmetry and same type of scaling. But at first, and this stopped us for many years, we didn't have a good answer to the following puzzle. If you write down, let's go back to n equals 1 supersymmetry in 2 plus 1 dimensions in superspace, I want to write down the kinetic term for the relativistic super Yang-Mills, because that was a part of the construction. And now I want to add to it the higher derivative spatial completion with z equal to 2 scaling. So I need a new term, which is an invariant under the super translations. And before we constructed those terms, if you remember from the previous transparencies, by taking wherever super derivatives showed up in the action and replacing them with spatial derivatives, because they cost you the same. Here, however, the bad surprise is that if you write down 2 plus 1 Yang-Mills in superspace, it's written in terms of this spinner superfield strength, W alpha squared, without any explicit derivatives anywhere. So you can't strip them off and put in spatial derivatives to get a new term. And at first, it looks like there is nothing else you can do, nothing you can build out of this W alpha superfield strength that would all of a sudden pick up these higher derivative spatial parts of this equal to 2 UV completion. So the project was dormant for a long time until we started working on this again a couple of years back with my student, Stephen Randall. And then we realized that you have to go really in order to solve this puzzle. So the punchline is there is indeed an n equals 1 super Yang-Mills in 2 plus 1 dimensions with z equal to 2 scaling. There is indeed an n equals 2 extension of it with z equal to 2 scaling. And they can indeed be found in superspace, but you have to redo the conventional construction of super Yang-Mills using superconnections. And you'll find out that, unlike in the relativistic case, not every invariant factorizes through this spinorial field strength. There's another invariant, which in the relativistic setting becomes dependent, but in the non-relativistic context is independent completely of this one. So long story short, you go back to superspace, introduce a superconnection for every derivative, so you have supercovariant derivatives, you have many different field strengths in superspace, you impose the conventional constraint as usual that the spinner-spinner component of the superfield is zero, and this has a solution in terms of this standard superfield strength W, and then you ask how many independent invariants I can now construct in consistently with the Aristotelian supersymmetry algebra. And it turns out you can still do W alpha as before, but the novelty here is that you can also do Wij, Wij. So the spatial-spatial component of the field strength of the super connection, which I've written here down in components, when you calculate Wij, Wij, you can take the full space, superspace integral of it, you pick up this component here, and you see that it has an interesting, almost unexpected exotic structure. It couples the magnetic field F to the derivative of the electric field. This is a z equal to 2 spatial part of the kinetic term, which is quite unexpected. It certainly isn't what we were looking for in components. This is also why it's so difficult at first to construct this term. It's less exotic in the fermionic sector. It's just second derivatives between two copies of the fermion, so that's what you would have expected. But this bosonic part comes out really exotic. And then you can also turn, it turns out you can show that there is a canonical transformation of the variables, which takes you to a more standard part of the term, which would be something like partial IF, partial IF. That's what you would have expected naively based on dealing with bosonic field theories. But once you perform this canonical transformation on the field components to get the canonical kinetic term for the gauge field, that actually makes the supersymmetry transformations very complicated, looking very unconventional. But it's all related just by a field order definition. So bottom line is there is an n equals 1 super Yang-Mills. It takes a somewhat surprising but unique and consistent form, can be constructed nicely in superspace. when you do the construction going back to the origins of supersymmetry in superconnection formulas. Now, so this clearly is heading towards, and since I'm virtually out of time, I should be wrapping up, so I don't have too many more transparencies. This is developing into a program. Now that we have shown as a proof of concept that you can do 2+1 nonlinear sigma models, you can do 2+1 super Young Mills, how far would the story extend? My dream is to have a similarly rich story in 6 dimensions and perhaps come up with new UV completions of supersymmetric theories, 1,0, 1,1, 2,0, pick your favorite. That would be really interesting because it might provide a non-string theory alternative, which relies only on the techniques of field theory in a fixed rigid spacetime, albeit at the cost of the theory developing UV and isotropies. So this is indeed what we have been working on. I could report more about the details. This is, in fact, my last transparency. I could tell you more about several of these examples. So let me just highlight one novelty. If you go beyond 2+1, so the first thing that happens, the reason we constructed n equals 2 super Young Mills in 2+1 dimensions is that, of course, that's an obvious stepping stone towards n equals 1 in 3+1 dimensions. As you can say, surely my n equals 2 super Young Mills in 2+1 dimensions comes from a simple dimensional reduction of the 3+1 dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetry. Surprisingly, that's not the case in the following sense. If you take your unique n equals 2 supersymmetric Young Mills that we found in 2+1 dimensions and lift it up to 3+1 dimensions, turns out it can never restore the full SO3 rotational invariance in space. So the only theory which has this type of property and descends to the n equals 2 super Young Mills in 2+1 dimensions will not even be SO3 invariant in 4 dimensions. It will have one special dimension in space. Even though it scales the same as the other dimensions, the residual symmetry is only the SO2 rotation in the spatial dimensions that you keep in the reduction down to 2+1. So that was a surprise that you can prove a no-go theorem saying postulating this supersymmetric structure and the minimal n equals 1 super Young Mills supermultiplet in 3+1 dimensions, you cannot have a theory which is Aristotelian with z equal to 2 and treats time as special versus 3 SO3 invariant spatial dimensions. You have to break the SO3 down to SO2, or you can do something else. And the something else that you can do is relevant to higher dimensional cases. The other thing you can do in 3+1 dimensions is to perform the split not between time and 3 dimensions of space. Instead, you can take 1+1 relativistic dimensions and the remaining 2 transverse dimensions as 2 separate groups, perform a z equal to 2 scaling between these 2 groups. So it's only going to be the 2 remaining dimensions of space which will end up generating higher derivative terms in the action. And then you can actually run the whole construction again and you find that there is indeed a unique n equals 1 for any choice of the non-abelian simple gauge group, you can find a unique n equals 1 supersymmetric Young Mills. In fact, if you have multiple different copies of such a theory with different gauge groups, they automatically all share the same speed of light in the infrared because they all share the same superalgebra, which knows about the speed of light through that supertranslation symmetry. So those would be theories with 4 supercharges in 4 dimensions. Currently, the state of the art is we are dealing with various realizations of UV completions at the classical level for pure Young Mills, super Young Mills with 1,0 supersymmetry. And again, there are interesting results. You are again asked to split the spacetime dimensions into the group of 2 versus 4 with z equal to 2 scaling. And then you can find theories which have this UV completion at the cost of not having to keep the entire SO4 spatial rotation symmetry. You have to break the SO4. Often, if you want to keep many supercharges, you have to keep only an abelian subgroup of the SO4 spatial rotation, which again is a surprise, but it's aligned with the tendency that these systems are much more unique, much rarer in existence. You have to have more structure available to you in order for them to exist so consistently than you would have in the absence of this non-relativistic structure. So Whether or not this can extend to 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions, at this point we have many blind alleys. We have no constructive proof that any of that works for 10 or 11 dimensions. But even the no-go theorems that we have established so far in those regimes are very interesting. They certainly suggest that there is no way of having a theory in 9 plus 1 dimensions with SO8 spatial rotation symmetry on 8 dimensions or more. That's ruled out by just a component proof by brute force that there's no such Aristotelian theory. But whether more exotic things with less spatial symmetry exist, that's an open question. So I would say at this point, this to me is an interesting research direction, and the results are still open. So either stay tuned or get involved in studying Aristotelian supersymmetry. Thank you.
Before asking for questions, I have one announcement. We're going to continue great condition started by Matthias since last week. And we're going to have a speaker's dinner downstairs at the bistro at 6 p.m. So please join us if you're interested.
General question. Thank you so much, Dr. Century. There's much to be heard by the latest and greatest of Mexican expressions.
Right.
So, the question is, why do we want to, why would we want to interpret Mexican expressions in terms of its Aristotelian?
Because we still have a few unanswered open questions phenomenologically from the 20th century, and I'm looking for any new ideas that might help provide new answers. For example, the hierarchy problems. I mean, relativity was a beautiful idea in the 20th century, but it is so 20th century now, right?
It's still with us.
I know. No, I'm perfectly happy and very respectful of it. Absolutely, it's a super important experimental constraint. That's why you cannot just claim the solution of the hierarchy problem very easily, because you have to satisfy the constraints on the Lorentz violations, which is the tougher part. Compared to the opening of the hierarchy all the way to the Planck scale, it was the easy thing, but the hard part is to make sure that you don't violate constraints. So on that topic, we don't explain why all the speeds of propagation of all the species in the standard model are the same. We are just showing that if you set them equal to each other, this is stable under quantum corrections in this setting. So it's technically natural. It doesn't explain why they all share the same speed of light. So it doesn't explain why the theory is relativistic, but just shows you if you are at the point where the theory is at low energy is very relativistic, this is not a fine tuning. Again, any interesting new ideas I think are worth studying in the absence of knowing how we solve the cosmological constant problem or the hierarchy problem. And for the supersymmetric theories, I think it's interesting to ask for any UV completions of six-dimensional super Young mills, regardless of whether the infrared, I mean, you can insist on infrared super Poincaré, and then whatever goes in the UV is fine as long as you can mathematically show that it's a consistent framework. So having a completion which is non-relativistic might be a useful alternative to having to embed this into some construction using brains and full string theory.
Certainly shown that the original reason for supersymmetry was to get rid of the fine-tuning problems.
Right.
It's now moved away.
Yeah, exactly. So I admit that my motivation for studying supersymmetry is very different from phenomenological motivations for gravity side of what I work on. So for me, there were two motivations. One of them was, can we provide these UV completions to people who are actually interested in studying and using six-dimensional field theories for something? For example, one of the strongest motivation came out of Ed Witten's paper from 2011 on five brains and knot theory, where he was using five-dimensional and six-dimensional quantum field theories, supersymmetric field theories, to construct knot invariants. And a big part of that paper consists of complaints, why don't we have a better UV completion of the theory besides string theory? Why do we have to embed everything into brain constructions? So seeing whether you can just complete the theory using the same degrees of freedom by just playing with the dispersion relations rather than inventing an infinite hierarchy of additional excitations in the theory seemed like an interesting motivation. And the second motivation for me was just to learn new tricks and see what other novelties we might use in the non-relativistic setting, hoping that I'll be able to address the gravity questions kind of more competently once we learn about gauge theories first. Well, it's easy to supersymmetrize gravity. It's difficult to make sure it reproduces super Poincaré supergravity, because it's already very difficult to show that in the bosonic sector you reproduce GR. So, but it's easy to supersymmetrize it. You can just engage a supergroup, and that's not a difficult thing. But to make it phenomenologically viable, or to derive it from string theory or embed it into string theory, that might be more challenging. But if you are just asking for the formal construction of a supersymmetric version of Lipschitz gravity that's just replacing a gauge bosonic Aristotelian symmetry group with a supergroup, and that's not a challenge.
So, returning to your hierarchies of epsilons, if I apply sort of bottom-up kind of logic in terms of the momentum scales, is it correct that your ultimate cutoff is a Planck scale, and then the transition to Lipschitz would be somewhere in the geometric mean between the Planck scale and the weak scale or something?
You have more structure to play with. I mean, the idea was to choose, because in that setting of that example with UV completion of the Higgs sector by Z equals 3, you have three epsilons to play with. So you can define your naturalness scale to be just above the Planck scale, let's say, or around the Planck scale. And then you are looking for using one epsilon to make sure that the Higgs mass is where it is. And then you use other epsilons to make sure that the Lorentz violations are just above the TV scale. So that was basically the numerology. And anything between is possible, because you have three epsilons in that simple model to play with. And that doesn't even include gravity. You could also couple gravity to it and claim similar hierarchies on the gravity side. So. As you know, it's a very viable scenario when you make only the gravity sector highly non-relativistic, but keep as much of the standard model as relativistic as you can. This is certainly a very sensible way where you can protect hierarchies and allow the speed of light not to be fine-tuned.
So usually, my understanding of condensed matter of many body physics, if you have a gapless excitation at low energies, it is protected by shift symmetry, spontaneous symmetry. But is there an example where you can start from a totally non-symmetric, you know, this kind of theory where there's no Lorentzian-like symmetry in the underlying Lagrangian and naturally flow without having a protected symmetry at the low energies,
I like precisely the logic of Tuft's technical naturalness. So I'm always looking for symmetries associated with protecting stuff. So I don't know of any mechanism. In fact, this came out of knowing at first that the speed terms, the correction, the lower degree corrections to a higher polynomial dispersion relation do not require fine tuning to be kept small. And then the question was, is there an example where you just naturally flow to something which has this surprising result, or is there a hidden symmetry? And after some searching, we found those shift symmetries, the polynomial shift symmetries, as an explanation. So my suspicion is that whenever that happens, there is always a hidden symmetry behind it. But I don't know of a single example where.
You have to start somehow in the class of theories which allows the symmetry, right? Otherwise, as you said,
it's self-consistent. Let's say you are an experimentalist in high TC superconductivity. So you play with so many materials, you tweak so many parameters, and then you hit on a superconductor where the dispersion relation of the longitudinal phonon has a large contribution that goes like omega scales as k to the third power, and maybe a small linear correction. And if you find a material like that, then there is automatically an emergent shift symmetry. It doesn't have to have a microscopic origin, or if it does, it's not known where it comes from. But if that material exists, then you know that that dispersion relation will be robust under small deformations of the system, because there is an emergent scale symmetry, I mean, emergent quadratic shift symmetry by observation. But it's just.
What property the underlying theory has to have in order to have this emergent symmetry?
If we did, we would have a condensed matter Nobel Prize for it, right? Because we could construct arbitrarily high TC superconductors using this. But so the answer is obviously we have no clue. But it's self-consistent in the sense that if that material exists, then you know that if the material exists where the phonon responsible for just the standard BCS mechanism has a cubic dispersion relation, then that's protected by an emergent polynomial shift symmetry simply by the properties of the low energy effective field theory. It's there by inspection, and where it came from microscopically, I don't know, because I don't know how to derive that this phonon has this cubic dispersion relation out of the microscopic physics. If I did know how to derive that, I would know where that shift symmetry came from. So both are equally phenomenological, but once it's the right description of the model, then it's going to be robust. So you can have linear resistivity for these systems across several orders of magnitude in the high TC superconductors, as people observe. So I'm not saying that's necessarily the mechanism that nature picks, but it's a mathematically self-consistent mechanism which would predict linear resistivity with temperature. And it would be robust under, it would not be fine-tuned, so it could stay linear across several orders of magnitude in temperature.
Any questions? Okay, if you can have questions for now, Petro will be around this
Yeah, all right.
And let's thank Petro again.